Daniel 8, 15 through 27. Then it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood. And when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. And he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the later time of the indignation. For at the appointed time, the end shall be. The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully, and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, that he shall be broken without human means. And the vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterwards, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. So we come to this vision once again, and we've got more about the explanation. I want for us to be looking at this and realizing that this is a vision, yes, that spoke of a particular instance of Antichrist. And by that I mean small a, power that sets itself up high and exalted against Jesus Christ, that power that the devil is always seeking to throw against the church. What I want now is to take a look at these words and seek to apply them personally to us. Now, what's going on? If you weren't here last week, it might be helpful, obviously, to go back and realize what's going on. Last week, we saw in Daniel verses 1 through 14 how this is the last year where Babylon will be an empire anymore. God is already raising up the Medes and the Persians to take over this ram that's going to throw down the Babylonian empire. And he's showing Daniel in a vision that was given him far to the east in the city of Susa, which would be the new capital of the Persian Empire. He's showing them signs and symbols and pictures about what God was going to do in the future and what was going to happen in the history of his people in particular, the people of God. How he is now raising up this ram, the Persian Empire, that's going to be his hand of judgment against the Babylonians. And after that, he's going to raise up a goat, the Greek Empire of Alexander, that's going to come rushing over the earth and destroy the Persian Empire. And that's exactly, of course, what Alexander did. And then how after Alexander had begun to compare himself to God, this mighty general who was unparalleled in ancient history, how he's going to be snapped like a twig in the prime of his life by God's hand, not by another empire. But then how out of Daniel, you're going to get four little horns on the goat, which are these four kingdoms, okay? The successors, the generals who would come in his place. Those are the kingdoms that would come up, but not with the original power of the first kingdom under Alexander that was spoken of. And then, of course, this little horn that is spoken of here, this terrible and wicked king, Antiochus Epiphanes, who would rise out of the Seleucid Empire, one of the four empires that came out in the north, and he would afflict the people of God. He would be turned against the land, and he would bring blasphemy upon them. He would be an affliction to all that was godly and righteous until, just like Alexander, in the prime of life, his power would be broken as well. But I want to speak of these things now in their application to us on a personal level. Because as I said, this vision wasn't given just for the church at the time of Antiochus, just so that the visible church at the time that he would come upon them and he would be persecuting them would be able to endure. It was given to teach all believers about the nature of all of these little horns that come up, all of these people possessed of the spirit of Antichrist. These people who rage against the Lord and His people, and who seek to destroy all that is holy, to cast down the kingdom, and instead to raise up their own kingdoms. I want to talk about the kind of culture that they engender, the way that they go about trying to destroy and subvert the kingdom, because it's always the same. You know, that's one of the saddest things. Antichrist and the spirit of Antichrist have not changed their general game plan for thousands of years. It goes all the way back to the garden and the way the devil operated against our parents. The sad thing is, we keep falling for it. Again and again and again. Nothing new under the sun. Same old deceits. Same old lies. And yet we, the people of God, are so often bought into it, unfortunately. But I want us to be reading this in particular as the church is being prepared for the coming not of the little a antichrist, all of these petty despots and so on who would raise themselves up against Christ, but the big A antichrist, the beast of Revelation, the man of lawlessness of 2 Thessalonians. I don't know if this is the time of the end. Obviously, we're in the end times. The end times are the period that stretched from Jesus' crucifixion to Jesus' return. We're in the end times, I can tell you that much. Are we in the end? That's what everybody wants to know. I don't know. It doesn't really matter in one sense, because shouldn't we be living the same way regardless? There was the old story told by Jonathan Wesley, Jonathan Wesley, the evangelist. A man came riding up to him and he said, "Mr. Wesley, what would you do if you knew that Jesus Christ was coming tomorrow?" And it said that he reached into his saddlebag, he took out his diary, and he read his appointments for the next day. He wouldn't do anything differently. To a certain extent, brothers and sisters, that should be exactly the way we're living our lives. Living as though Christ might come back tomorrow or tarry for another 1,000 years. Either way, standing solid on the foundation that He has laid. Anyway, as these verses open, Daniel wants an explanation for what's going on. That's very natural. He's had all these signs, these pictures and so on. He wants to know, what does this mean? And the Lord, who knows the desires of our hearts, isn't going to leave him in the dark. So he commands the archangel Gabriel to explain the vision to him. Now, Calvin, when it comes to the opening here, and the voice that commanded Gabriel, make known to Daniel what's going on. He believes that that voice was Christ, the pre-incarnate Christ. And I tend to agree with him. Who else can command the mightiest of the angels, the archangel Gabriel, but the Holy One of God? The wonderful number of Palmoni, as he's called in the Hebrew here. I tend to agree with Calvin on that point, but as I said, I'll lift my hand whenever I'm speculating. It might be Christ, it might be another angel. Anyway, Daniel is terrified, at the approach of Gabriel, okay, coming to him. And he essentially passes out at this point. Now, this should be a lesson to us as well. If this strong and holy Christian, a man who had been through persecution and terrible events, reacted this way to the presence of an angel, oh, brothers and sisters, it should tell us immediately how impossible it would be for a man to stand in the presence of the holy God without having his sins atoned for. Brothers and sisters, if angels are this frightening, how frightening is the utterly holy one who has created the universe, in whose presence can dwell no sin? But God is gracious. God has of course, redeemed. And Gabriel now essentially picks him up, because Gabriel isn't there to receive worship from him, and he dusts him off and explains what's going to happen in the later time of indignation. It's an interesting phraseology. That's a reference not to the end of the world, but to the end of the time of God's indignation with the Jews prior to the coming of the Messiah. It's referring to the end of all of the things that unfolded, including the exile that they were sent into, because of their transgressions. Because of the wicked things that they did, the Lord warned them. If you keep going on in this way, terrible transgressions will come upon you. My indignation is growing full, and you're getting to the point where I'm going to break out against you. I'm going to do all the things that I warned you I would do through the prophets. And He has done them. Now, the things that were to come before the first coming of the Messiah are what is being spoken of here, the end of the Old Testament period, so on. Now, I say this in particular because if you have a Scofield Reference Bible, then you know, and I hope nobody has a Scofield Reference Bible. Anyway, if you do, you know that Scofield thought that this was all about the end of the world. Okay, but we know that's not true. We know that the prophecy that's being spoken of here is not about the end of the world, because the time periods are spelled out explicitly for us. We have Persia, we have Greece, we have the four kingdoms, and then we have this one kingdom of Antiochus arising out of Syria, tormenting Israel, and then being destroyed by God, but not the Messiah coming at that point to end all things. Now, a lot of commentators are kind of amazed in that while they expect Scofield to try to correct all the reformed exposition that came before his time in the 19th century, they are amazed that he's also trying to correct Gabriel. No, you got it wrong. It's not actually the four kingdoms that came up after Alexander. It's actually the end of the world. But that's not what's happening. What these verses make clear is that Antiochus Epiphanes is going to come, and he is this sinister schemer, this deceitful man, this little antichrist who is crafty. Very crafty in the way that he seeks to overthrow the worship of the living God and destroy the saints. Because the way he did it was, first, he did it through cultural influence. What does Antiochus want? Okay? What is his desire? Well, he wanted his empire to have one culture and one religion that he could control and be at the center of. He didn't want many cultures, many different religions. And almost every antichrist has attempted to do that, to create this one kingdom, so to speak. Stalin, with his program of Russianization and the spread of communism. Napoleon, who goes conquering and bringing the philosophy of the French Revolution to all of the European capitals and states. Hitler, of course, with his pagan vision of this Aryan Nordic people's empire. And Muhammad, with his terrible vision of one worldwide Dar el Islam. Now, what are these antichrists doing? They're creating, or attempting to create, a counterfeit kingdom of God with a counterfeit Christ at the center. I hope you see that. These men want to style themselves as God. And that's one thing about the devil that I want you to see. Okay? The best he can do is pervert the true and the good. To take that which God has given man and to counterfeit it, to flip it over and to try to create an evil version. Those of you who are familiar with the Lord of the Rings series, even if you're not, that's okay. You'll remember that Saruman created this race of men who weren't really men, who were just evil and perverse. They were hybrids. He couldn't create anything truly new. He could just take that which existed and pervert it. The devil is the same way. He tries to create a perverted kingdom of God. So, the problem for Antiochus is that as you look at his empire, well, he can Hellenize most of it, but there's this one thorn in his side. This one thing that makes him so angry, and that's Israel. The Jewish people are standing in his way. So his aim is to corrupt the culture of the people of God and to Hellenize them. Now, Hellenic is a word meaning Greek. He wants to make them Greek. He wants to replace the Jewish culture based on the teaching of the Bible and replace it with a Greek culture based upon humanism, based upon the Greek pantheon, these false gods that the Greeks had erected for themselves. That's the culture that he wants them to adopt. So what does he do? Well, he doesn't immediately come full force against Israel. Okay? What he does was he initially tried to spread Hellenism through Hellenized Jews. Men who had forgotten the gods of their fathers. Men who had essentially sold out quislings of their race. Who were eager to advance this brave new world that Antiochus is peddling. Because they saw themselves as, so to speak, getting in on the bottom floor of the new empire. I'll be somebody who can stand alongside him. Now, Antiochus wasn't going to allow anybody to have power anywhere near his. But he's a deceitful man, a crafty schemer, who use anything to advance his program. And so through these men, these apostate Jews, he introduced Greek culture, Greek thinking, Greek philosophy, Greek sports. And in that, he aimed at the youth. Because the devil is not stupid, brothers and sisters. Why did he aim at the youth? Because he knew that if he could train up a few generations of Jews to be Hellenized, apostates, he knew he could break the chain whereby faith is transmitted from parent to child. Your enemy, the devil, knows that. And he strives to break the chain whereby fathers instruct their sons, mothers instruct their daughters in the way of godliness, and to replace it with another culture, another philosophy, another worldview. He wants to bring Israel to the terrible point where she forgets God and her law once again and becomes just like the surrounding nations. But this campaign wasn't successful. He found that he could only go so far. He could corrupt those who were externally in the church. externally members of the kingdom, but not internally. He found out the hard way that the Lord preserves his elect. The men and women and children who are genuinely converted, he can't change. He can't corrupt them in that sense. So Antiochus gradually gets more and more repressive. For instance, he introduced a death penalty for circumcising your children, which applied both to the mother and the child. Fairly severe. The scriptures were banned. The Sabbath was eliminated. The Hebrew that the scriptures were written in was replaced by Koine Greek. You couldn't even speak the language of scripture. And the only religion that was acceptable was this Hellenized or Greekized version of the Jewish faith. They even erected a statue of Zeus, as we said last week, in the temple in Jerusalem and sacrificed piggies there. It was an awful, awful event. Now, troops go from village to village attempting to enforce these edicts. It's easy for him to mess with the culture in Jerusalem because it's a big city. It's harder to get to the outlying villages. And many tens of thousands of Jews, both in Jerusalem and the outlying districts throughout Judea, who resisted Hellenization, died throughout this period. It's like a mini Holocaust going on. But finally, in 167, Antiochus' soldiers come to a town called Modin. This town is north of Jerusalem. And in this town dwelt, and this is the unlikely hero of the period, this old priest by the name of Matthias. Now, Matthias was the well-respected elder of the village, and the king's representative, that is King Antiochus, comes to Matthias and he says, look, you're a priest, you're respected. All we want you to do is sacrifice a pig on the altar in the center of the village. We'll move on. You won't have any problems. It's like with the Romans. All you have to do, burn that pinch of incense. Say, Caesar is Lord. It's all you need to do. Matthias won't do it. Okay, he refuses to do so, and he says, even, he's reported as saying, even if every nation obeys the king, each forsaking its ancestral religion to conform to his decrees, I, my sons, and my brothers will follow the covenant of our ancestors. May heaven preserve us from forsaking the law and its observances. As for the king's orders, we will not follow them. We shall not swerve from our religion, either to the right or to the left. And I wish that, or right or to the left. I wish that was our declaration today. In any event, a Levite from the village steps forward to take Matthias' place. He'll do it, even if Matthias isn't willing to. Matthias is enraged. He kills the Levite, and then he kills the king's representative. Now, as you can imagine, this has put him in kind of considerable hot water. All right? So what does he do? He and his sons take to the hills, and they begin this unlikely but amazingly successful guerrilla war against the forces of a mighty Greek empire. Antiochus' generals can't subdue the family of Matthias and his followers. It's an amazing thing. Now, Matthias dies, and then he's succeeded by the man that everybody remembers, a man by the name of Judah Maccabee. His name literally means Judah the Hammer. He's the hammer of God. The chief, so to speak, of the rebellion against Antiochus and his forces. And he and his rebels are always outnumbered. They are always out-equipped, but they win. They win battle after battle because the Lord is with them. And eventually, in 164 BC, Judah is able to enter the holy city. He's able to recapture Jerusalem. This is an amazing thing. And he's able to cleanse and rededicate the temple exactly as Daniel had prophesied to the very day. Because God's hand is upon him, just as God's hand earlier had been upon pagans like Alexander to progress them. When God is with us, who can stand against us, Paul says. And so the unlikeliest of heroes becomes the cleanser of the temples. And they rededicate the temple, and they find, according to Maccabees, that they don't have enough oil for the candelabrum that stood in the sanctuary. So what do? They send for more. They have to send to the outlying regions because all of the oil in Jerusalem has been contaminated through unholy worship and unclean sacrifices. So they send out for more, and they only have one day's supply of good oil to use in the candelabra. But the great miracle that the Jews remember is that the one day's oil burns for 8 days until the next batch of oil can be brought in. And that is the celebration that we know today as Hanukkah. That is what's being celebrated, the Festival of Lights, or Festival of the Rededication. And to this day, Jews celebrate it by lighting a candle on the menorah for each of the 8 days that the oil lasted during that rededication process. Now, 1 year later, in keeping with the prophecy of verse 25, that is, he shall be broken without human means, Antiochus died He dies through this mysterious disease while he's returning from Persia in 163 BC. Just as was the case with Alexander before him, God simply reaches out and snaps the twig. This man at the height of his power becomes nothing at all. His army couldn't crush the people of God, and he was never outside of God's hand, God's power. God used him for his own ends. Even evil, we remember, we learned that today, even evil can be used for God's own ends. And then he snaps him for his rebellion. Now, what can we personally learn from this? I want to suggest to you we can learn a ton of things. Like I said, Antichrist's game plan, the devil's game plan against you, the followers of Jesus Christ, and the kingdom of God hasn't changed. Same plan, different day. Okay? Now, the spirit of Antichrist is not stupid. It is quite shrewd. Antichrist doesn't begin his campaign against the church with open warfare. What does he do? He begins the same way Antiochus did, with the gradual corruption of the society, the gradual corruption of the church, and the degree to which men embrace that corruption is the degree to which they are applauded by the culture. We read in Revelation that the beast will give a mark, we're not quite sure what that means, by which all men will do business, but if they're not part of his system, they're outcasts. The first way that he works, he establishes this pariah system. You're in the know. You're in the in-group if you're conforming to his way. We see that in academia, for instance, in the way that if you don't kowtow to the Darwinist line, you go nowhere in science. I have known biochemists who know that Darwinian evolution cannot produce the complex structures, the chemical information train in DNA. Darwinism has no explanation for the creation of knowledge, the creation of information. And that's what the DNA chain really is. These biochemists know it, and yet they have to go on pretending that it can create something that it has no capacity to do. Because if they don't, what will happen to them? It'll be the end of their tenure. It'll be the end of their career. They will be on the skids. They'll be lucky if they get a job in a podunk Christian college somewhere in the middle of nowhere. So what do? They kowtow. They burn the pinch of incense. They say, it's just a pig. I'll sacrifice it. What does he do? He gradually corrupts us, gradually corrupts our values. Now, think about all the other ways that Antiochus corrupted the society and he's corrupting us today. Antiochus banned the scriptures from society. Now, we live in a time when the Bible and the teaching of it are virtually banned from the public square. We have chaplains who can't pray in the name of Christ at a public event. Try telling a Muslim he can't pray in the name of Allah in a public event. People would be outraged. It's not even asked. We live in a time when any obscenity that men can think of will be defended as a First Amendment right, but a high school valedictorian better not mention Jesus or her mic gets turned off. We live in a time that is attempting to expunge Scripture and the name of Christ from our society and has been highly successful, I might add, in doing that. Antiochus, secondly, eliminated the Sabbath. He eliminated the Lord's Day. In our own time, we are watching as day after day, Lord's Day after Lord's Day, Sunday, the Lord's Day, evaporates. As it becomes more and more like any other day. As it disappears from public recognition. And the saddest thing, brothers and sisters, is that the Lord's people and the Lord's church are assisting in that process. As men stand up and say, it doesn't matter what you do on Sunday. That's a legalistic idea that you have to keep the Lord's Day holy, that it should be a day set aside for works of piety, necessity, and mercy. No, no, no. Go out to dinner. Go out to lunch. Go shopping. Go on a vacation. Do whatever you want. It's just another day after all. And gradually, God's people say, yeah, that's right. It's just another day after all. And so I can go and do business, not thinking that other people are having to work in order that I can go and do business or go and buy things or go on vacation. And then gradually more and more people can work. And gradually we see more and more signs now open on Sunday. And what do you think will happen 50 years from now when we want to meet at 11 o'clock and everybody's employer is saying, what are you, crazy? It's another day. I expect you to be here for work. We will have eliminated also a reminder that the culture can't stand that Christianity still exists. The Lord's Day. It will have evaporated from our midst. So, how else did Antiochus get rid of the Lord's Day? He used sports. Now, if there's a bigger idol in our culture today than sports, I don't know what it is. All right, it is the American Idol, aside from that awful show. It is almost by the... Antiochus gave out this edict that the Sabbath would become a day, instead of worshiping the Lord, instead of ceasing from our labors and our recreations, he set it aside as a day for wrestling, for hurling the discus, for doing all of these Greek sports. And Antichrist have always, believe it or not, used sports this way. For instance, in 1633, Charles I... he's fighting against this growing Puritan revival in his own kingdom of England. A reformation is going on. So what does he do? He issues this declaration of sports, stating that various sports and dances and feasts are all acceptable Sunday recreations and that the people should be engaged in them. And then he commands that the ministers read his edict from their pulpits in these churches. And I love what one Puritan minister did. He said to his congregation at the end of the service, he holds up the king's declaration and he says, "The king commands that I must read this pronouncement. But he does not command that you must hear it." So he dismissed the church and then read the edict to the empty church. He technically complied. I wish more of us had that kind of spirit. Anyway, today we had, obviously, not only the big obvious Sabbath-breaking institution, the NFL, we also see a profusion, and you must have noticed this, of youth leagues. More and more of us are being asked to bring our kids on Sunday. Why not Sunday? It's just another day. You got the day off. Why not go and play a game? So more and more people are going and doing that instead. Another thing, Antiochus corrupted the religion of the Jews. What did he do? He replaced it with a Hellenized abomination. And today, Christianity obviously is being overwhelmed by modernity, overwhelmed by the spirit of the age. Now, we have that in the liberal church, obviously, and we all see that. The liberal church simply parroting whatever the progressive wing of the culture is saying. Well, this abomination is good now? Okay, we're in favor of that. That's what I'm going to preach. But we seldom think that we as evangelicals are also being eaten up by this. What ways is that happening? Well, first we see it in the politicization of the church. Brothers and sisters, we can see how bad it is when the liberal church becomes simply a wing of liberal politics, parroting whatever they say. But brothers and sisters, I have to tell you this, it is just as bad if we become a wing of conservative politics. And that becomes our primary emphasis, okay? I have seen churches become conservative politically, but amazingly theologically liberal. The sky's the limit. Anything goes. And we see the cultural corruption of our worship advancing. The loss of our theology. Start talking about theology and evangelicals' eyes roll back in their heads. Well, that's divisive. We're actually parroting the kind of things that liberals said in the 19th century. Oh, doctrine divides. We need peace. It's how you feel that's important. What is that? That's liberal 19th century theology, and it's become our reigning theology in the evangelical church. It's crazy. But that's how it progresses. It's subtle. It's not an outward attack. But brothers and sisters, we need to remember that just as those things were only the beginning of Antiochus' attack on the Lord and his people, so they are only the vanguard of what's coming in our own society. It's only the beginning of the campaign. Now, I'm sure the Jews looking at what was going on in this society must have said, this is as bad as it gets. It can't get worse than it is today. And it has always been the case that Christians, believers, have looked around the state of their society and concluded that everything has to end soon. This is as bad as it's ever been. It can't get any worse. Things are just too bad. Society is too lawless. Persecution is too severe. The Antichrist is just going nuts. Christ has to come back now. This has to be the moment I insist on it. And so they begin planning that way. But, I mean, again and again, they've been wrong. Martin Luther, for instance, reflecting on the state of affairs in his own time, looked around and he said, "The world cannot stand long, perhaps 100 years at the outside." Now, he wrote that in 1538. It was a little off, obviously, but that's pretty common, unfortunately, for the people of God. It does get worse. It gets worse before it can get better. It did for the Jews, and it will for us. So what do we do? What do we do? Well, first, the first thing we do is we do what the people of God did in Antiochus' time. We resist the first series of steps. They resisted the Hellenization of their culture, even unto death. We need to resist it as well. Now, the chaff in the church will not resist. But the chaff is blown away when that wind blows. And unfortunately, that's when the majority of men get blown away by the Antichrist. The people who love the world more than Christ get carried away, swept up in it. For instance, the men whose true sports, whose true heart idol, what they really worship is sports. Do you think they're going to stand in persecution? How can they? The NFL is not going to take a stand against Antichrist. It's not going to lead them. They will be swept away with the tide. No, this is just a little bit of, it's compromise. It's just a little bit of compromise. That's all we got to do. We are reminded by Paul. He says, there is a time coming when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. Brothers and sisters, we will only resist that if we love Christ more than anything else in this world. If our hearts cleave to Him, we know we can resist it. 1 John 2:15, though, tells us that we cannot love the world and Christ. We can't have dual citizenship, so to speak, between the world and the kingdom of heaven. Do not love the world or the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. Now, I'm not saying that you can't be good Americans and good citizens. I am, however, saying you cannot be good worldlings and good inhabitants of the kingdom of heaven. And I hope you see that. You can't be swept up in the world's value system and still adhering to the kingdom of heaven. And the degree to which you are swept up in the world system is the degree to which your heart will be taken off of Christ. Second, know that it will get worse. I know people are like, wow, what a message. It's never dark, but it's darker. You know, that's... Thanks, Pastor. Well, the spirit of Antichrist is abroad in the world already. And the Word tells us, and experience tells us, and history tells us that it will get worse. If he can't break you, brothers and sisters, by assimilation, and I pray he can't break anybody in this room by assimilation, by cultural corruption, he will attack you directly. That's exactly what Antiochus did, and that's exactly what every Antichrist has done. Remember what happened under Rome, what happened under Islam, what happened under communism. First, they tried the cultural change, and then they attacked the church head on. But what happened? The worship went underground. Yeah, the visible churches may be destroyed, but you can knock down a building. You can never knock down the believers. You can never change a heart that has been captivated by Christ. You can never knock that down. So, brothers and sisters, even if you are driven underground, do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together. Follow the example of the evangelical church in China, which has grown and prospered despite terrible persecution. Like them, be willing to go on meeting. Be willing to go on baptizing your children. Be willing to go on evangelizing even to the point of death. And if you think you cannot, if you think that this is more than I can bear, think then of the words of Paul that he wrote to the church from prison. He said this, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Not some things, brothers and sisters. You can endure. This is where faith is tested, is strengthened, and is proven. The third and finally, remember always, okay, I've said it's going to get darker. But remember this, it's always darkest before dawn. When was Antiochus' power broken? It was broken when he seemed unstoppable. The same God who raises up kings swept him out of the way as easily as you would crush a fly. Easier even. Remain true to your first love, brothers and sisters, and know that when it seems darkest, the sun is about to rise. The sun is about to rise upon you with healing in his wings. He shall triumph in that day. And you will be more than conquerors. Not through your own strength. You will be more than conquerors in that day through him who loved us. Jesus Christ is going to return. And in that day, all of the things that have oppressed, that have destroyed, that have ground down the people of God will seem as nothing. Well, brothers and sisters, remember, it is always darkest before dawn. And having hunted in the woods, I found that to be true. It will be a bad day coming. But remember that day is a glorious signpost that says Christ is coming.